With SDPB News, I'm John Wynn. The Brookings City Council has passed a mask requirement for indoor public spaces where 6 feet of social distancing is not possible. That decision comes after nearly 3 hours of public comment. SDPB's Jackie Hendry has more.
Many opposed to the ordinance cited outdated or limited studies that say masks aren't effective for mitigating spread of the coronavirus. Many others cited concerns about eroding civil liberties. Attorney Jared Gass called the mandate a line in the sand.
Asking the healthy for the appeasement of the frightened is no way to govern a city needing to shut this down right now. What's next?
Hold it. Please, no applause.
Others, like Julie Erickson, say previous trauma and health issues can prevent people from wearing a mask. She says her daughter has been harassed for not wearing one.
We don't need that kind of division and that kind of behavior in our city. Don't mandate division, please. It's already there. Let's not make it worse.
Many in favor of the mandate spoke over Zoom, like SDSU professor Sam Smith.
While I understand the appeal to personal responsibility, when you walk into a public space and pass a virus to a family's grandparent, aunt, uncle, who ends up dying, how are we to hold you responsible for that?
Several doctors and other healthcare providers also spoke in favor of the mandate, saying current scientific consensus shows masks are effective. City Council member Nick Wendell was the first to speak after public comment.
Mask wearing is not only pro-science and pro-public health, it is pro-economic recovery. So I will support the citywide mask mandate for those reasons.
The 60-day ordinance passed 5-2. The council also passed a resolution with several exemptions, including for those with mental health or other conditions. For South Dakota Public Broadcasting, I'm Jackie Hendry.
Governor Kristi Noem is blasting a study that finds the Sturgis motorcycle rally is linked to over 250,000 coronavirus cases across the country and responsible for $12 billion in public health costs. One state lawmaker says the study asks a unique question about the impact of the rally. SDPB's Elise Trubinger reports.
The study uses anonymized smartphone data from a company called SafeGraph, which found rallygoers traveled from all corners of the country to the Black Hills for the 10-day event. Governor Noem calls the report fiction and an attack on those exercising their personal freedom to attend the Sturgis rally. State epidemiologist Josh Clayton says the report doesn't align with what the state knows about impacts among rally attendees.
While this has been issued as a white paper, white papers are not peer-reviewed publications, that the study does use an ecologic approach that in my review so far did not account for an already increasing trend of cases within the state.
Clayton says the state knows of 124 cases of COVID-19 among South Dakota residents. The study looks at the swell of coronavirus spread nationally in the weeks during and after the rally. State Senator Reynold Nessebaugh is a Democrat from Sioux Falls. He's an economics professor at Augustana University. He says a peer-reviewed study would be of higher quality. However, he says the study is asking an interesting question. What are the negative impacts of having the Sturgis motorcycle rally during a pandemic?
All sorts of models have their limitations, and we talk about them in that context in our classrooms and our conferences and in our conversations with each other in referee journal articles. So they're using an interesting data set. They have a novel approach to try and solve this question. And I think it's the beginning of a conversation, not the end of the conversation.
Nessebaugh says the research attempts to give people a sense of the magnitude of the Sturgis rally and its after effects. He says calling the study a fraud is misplaced. The authors of the paper did not return a request for comment. For South Dakota Public Broadcasting, I'm Lee Strupinger in Rapid City.
The Sichanggu Community Development Corporation is a finalist for an international prize. The Rockefeller Foundation's Food System Vision Prize aims to create sustainable and accessible food systems around the world by 2050. Sichanggu CDC is one of 10 finalists out of more than 1,000 applicants from around the world. SDPB's Jackie Hendry has more.
Sichuan CDC's 7-Gen food system plan aims to increase access to locally produced, healthy foods on the Rosebud Reservation. The organization refined their plan after becoming one of 75 semifinalists for the Rockefeller Foundation's prize. Michael Prate is the development director with Sichuan CDC.
We viewed it as the first gen vision of a 7-gen plan, basically. You know, what would we want to accomplish in the next 25, 30 years?
Community members expressed a desire for local meat processing options, fresh produce, and more. Prate says the next step for finalists is called a virtual acceleration phase.
You get to do a 15-week refinement of your vision again, but you get connected to all these international mentors, food system experts, you know, specific pieces who are connected to the different aspects of our vision.
Sichuan CDC Director Weezipon Little Elk says this recognition affirms the work the organization has been doing for years.
And the work that we have going on here is innovative and that is needed by the rest of the world, honestly. And that indigenous thinking, and for us, you know, Lakota thinking, is what's going to provide the solutions for, you know, the next 175 years for humanity's survival.
Each finalist is eligible to receive a $200,000 prize. The Rockefeller Foundation will announce its top visionaries for the Food System Vision Prize in December. For South Dakota Public Broadcasting, I'm Jackie Hendry.
The Seventh Circuit Court-Appointed Special Advocates Program, or CASA, is one of several social services programs throughout the nation that are navigating through the COVID-19 pandemic while also trying to provide important services to neglected and abused children. SDPB's Richard Tubles has more on how CASA is adapting its program.
The Seventh Circuit Court CASA program serves more than 200 children annually in Pennington, Custer, and Fall River counties. The program pairs neglected and abused children with advocates who represent them and have their best interests in mind toward an appropriate outcome in legal proceedings. The results determine the child's future. Now in the pandemic with social distancing, advocates gotten creative in how they stay in touch with their CASA children. Phone calls and apps like Zoom have been the go-to way to interact, but the personal human connection is missing. According to CASA Executive Director Kay Halla Tubles, that's the most important part.
You know, everyone is trying to do a good job given the situation, but given the situation leaves a lot of leeway for less than perfect services right now. Just for one example, almost all therapy got switched over to Zoom or, if necessary, over the phone therapy. And it's just not the same experience for people. And the same is true for advocacy. Because of safety concerns for our volunteers and also for the kids we serve, who oftentimes are high risk medically, we had to set some boundaries around in-person visitations. And it's really difficult to have all of those subtle, trust-building, really nurturing relationship experiences over a Zoom call or over a phone call. We don't have the same kind of casual flow of information as if a volunteer gets to pick up a kid, go on a drive, get a milkshake, go to the park. Information flows out in a different way. Trust gets built in a different way. And we know that it's not happening right now for kids, so they're lonely and spread out.
One volunteer advocate got creative. Victoria Sweden has been a volunteer since 2017. She came up with a unique way to connect with her CASA kid that created a stronger and more intimate bond.
I did some brainstorming with a volunteer coordinator, and we came up with the idea to exchange a journal. And then I brought it to my CASA kid and see if she would be interested in doing something like that. She said she was, and so I would write an entry in it, drop it in their mailbox, and then pick it up after she had responded to it. And we've been able to have much more fruitful conversations that way and really, you know, keep our connection strong. She might have more time to think about what she wants to say to me, and maybe if she doesn't feel open to saying those a certain something that's going on, you know, in person. Sometimes people, it's easier for them to write it out when you're not directly facing someone and talking to them that way. So I think it's allowed her to maybe even open up a little bit more in different ways.
It's the same goal that Sarah Kelly hopes for. Not only does she work for the South Dakota Unified Judicial System, but she also oversees the state administrated CASA program.
You know, that the key is that we want to keep the children healthy and safe. We want to keep volunteers and staff healthy and safe, and the community healthy and safe. So, you know, they're being very respectful of, you know, social distancing and wearing face masks. The advocates, they do truly bond with these children. And at sometimes they are, the advocates are their only constant in their life. I mean, because, you know, as you may know, children are, you know, removed from their home, placed in foster care, possibly placed in another foster care, gone to a residential facility, returned home, things don't go well, they come back into foster care. So there's a lot of movement with these kids, but that CASA volunteer is that one person that has stayed with them, and they know Betty Smith is my volunteer, and she's going to come see me every month.
According to Kehala Tubals, nationwide, there has been a downtick in children entering the program's care since most schools closed their doors last school year. But in larger communities like Rapid City and Sioux Falls, it's a different story.
Hopefully, we've all built empathy for just how hard it is to be parents and balance life. But in terms of actual abuse and neglect scenarios, there's a lot less that's being reported nationwide. However, Pennington County hasn't seen that much of a decrease. We're having a very large volume of cases before this started, and a larger volume of acute cases, which means like sexual abuse or physical abuse versus neglect cases. 2020 was looking like a very full docket, and we haven't seen much of a decrease, even with people being out of school, lots of people seeing a downtick in number of maybe medical appointments that they're attending or things like that.
Getting advocation for the abused and neglected children in their care is often a challenge for the program due to the amount of time spent in classrooms. Since COVID hit, they streamlined their application process utilizing programs like Zoom, something according to Tubals they may continue into the future.
Honestly, I'd like to say that we hit the ground running from day one, but we've been reeling just as much as everyone else. We were able to restructure the things we already had on track. We were able to train a new class of CASA volunteers completely remotely. We were able to keep those swearing in dates flowing, keep new advocates entering the system. We've also had a lot of our already trained advocates be really great and reach out and say, hey, I'm working from home, or I have some more spare time, I want to take a second case. So we've been assigning a lot of cases, but access to brand new people who aren't in our network, who aren't already, you know, signed up from a previous recruiting event, that's been a struggle for us. We're trying to restructure right now and come up with some social media campaigns and things like that, but it's been very difficult because our work is relational, our work is person to person, and we find that when we're really able to talk to people and share our passion about the mission, we're able to get them involved. And so again, that distance, it's been a learning process for us on how to bridge that.
Although this year continues to have uncertainty, Tubal said CASA will strive to provide their pivotal services to abused and neglected children.
We don't know what's going to happen next, but we do know that we're still 100% committed to advocating for the best interest of children in our community. We will continue with our direct advocacy. We will continue training volunteers, recruiting volunteers, and advocating for children who really need a voice so that they can have the best future possible.
The same vision is shared by Victoria Sweden. She says while the program does its best to help children have the best outcome, an advocate can also have a lifelong presence in a child's life.
Being an advocate for me is very rewarding. I take honor in being able to be a friend or just a constant in someone's life that doesn't have it. It makes me feel really happy knowing that I can have a positive influence on a child. I've developed really good friendships with my CASA children. I still talk to my previous children every once in a while, just keep in touch. It's awesome to watch them grow, and I would recommend anyone who likes to work with children. It's a nice friendship to build, and you just you help them out by getting to know them and watching them succeed.
Currently, the Seventh Circuit CASA program is seeing an unusually high number of cases even during the pandemic, with a waiting list of 380 abused and neglected children. The next training class for advocates is in October. For South Dakota Public Broadcasting, I'm Richard Tubels in Rapid City.
Those are the stories from today. Be sure to follow SDPB News on Twitter and Facebook, and check out sdpb.org to read up on all of our news and politics coverage. From the entire SDPB journalism team, I'm Josh Heyer. Thank you for listening.